and welcome. This is take two from Kermit and Mayo's take. Is that right? Yeah. So this is take two from Kermit and Mayo. Anyway, in a moment, the door will open and Mark will say thank you.
Yes.
And just so that you know, he'll be saying thank you to Flynn, who's one of our excellent production team. But this is just to give it some kind of context.
I'll be saying thank you because she will be bringing coffee. I'm not randomly saying thank you.
You do randomly, and everyone goes, why are you saying thank you? And I have to explain every time. So I'm just ahead of the time saying.
The word I use more than thank you is sorry.
Okay. Well, when she comes in, you say
apologize
thank you
first,
sorry.
Find out what you're apologizing for later.
Listener Richard Flanagan in Shropshire sent me this. I don't know why, but. Oh, yes, that's right. Because he sent a little thing of Keanu saying it's Quantum Baby.
Oh, right. Okay.
And this is the story.
Oh, yes. I've seen that. It's on Twitter. Yeah, yeah.
A chip that can transmit all of the internet's traffic every second.
What? Okay?
This is a single computer chip has transmitted a record 1.84 petabits. A petabit is a multiplier by a quadrillion.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. My first corduroy not being coat of the realm. Now this.
1.8 petabits of data per second via a fiber optic cable, enough bandwidth to download 230 million photographs in that time, and more traffic than travels through the entire internet per second. There you go. My new phone. I want a petabit.
That's right.
That's, by the way, I'm reading word for word from New Scientist.
Do you know how many megabytes I get where I live? And this is on the new. Thank you very much.
Thank you and sorry.
On the new speeded up broadband that I've got?
Yes.
8.
That's not very good, is it? Not 8 petabits.
No.
8 bits.
Megabytes, right.
Just 8 bits. Anyway, Richard, thank you very much. And thank you to New Scientist. It's a head spinning story.
Do you like a good scientific journal? Do you ever read Scientific American?
I used to buy New Scientist when I was writing a lot of sciencey stuff in the books.
When you were doing
because Itch was
I'm sorry, science-y. I have to bring this up because now we're allowed to because all the kind of gloves are off and everything. Itch,
yes.
Your book,
yeah,
is becoming an opera.
I know.
I know that I wasn't telling you because
I
thought you didn't know. It was a rhetorical device to go.
Yeah.
Itch is this again. My mind has been blown so many times recently. But I was round at your house last night, Lady in the Van, Bendix Bitterments.
Yes,
and you said I have to go to see.
This is tonight.
Fine. Because it just so tells this is such astonishing news.
Yeah, it is. Opera Holland Park have commissioned
that new train station.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure it's on the Elizabeth line somewhere. James Clutton is the producer there, read Itch and thought it would make a good opera. So he went to one of the leading British composers at the moment, Jonathan Dove, and said, well, let's turn this into an opera. So I contributed the story, but I don't know how you turn anything into an opera. And tonight there's a little kind of preview of some of the tunes and some of the people involved.
And so, sorry, just because this is so far out of my
me too.
Wheelhouse. So they've written songs to be sung by characters that you created.
Yes.
But songs that you haven't written.
Correct.
Somebody else has written.
Yes. So there's a librettist and there's a composer.
The librettist is the spoken word between songs, or is the whole thing?
I think
song?
the words, oh, and the composer is Jonathan.
So does the whole? Sorry, forgive my ignorance. I'm not asking this for comedy purposes. In an opera, is everything sung?
Sometimes and sometimes not. Sometimes, so in Marriage of Figaro, there is spoken word and then they sing and then there are arias. So, and I don't know because I don't know what form this is going to take. I guess that there will be speech and then there will be tunes and arias.
Marriage of Figaro is the thing about which Morgan Freeman's character in Shawshank Redemption says, I have no idea what those two ladies were singing about. Remember when he plays the thing over the...
And you don't need to.
You don't need to, yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
okay,
I
hold you in very high esteem anyway, but the fact that you have now written a work that has been turned into an opera by Opera Holland Park.
Well, believe me, no one is more surprised than me.
It's just amazing. Just amazing. You will go to opening night.
My plan at the moment is to go to everyone every night. So it's on. So next...
Will you sit with a flute of champagne?
Well, I'll
and a little canape?
Yeah. because I think it's the least I could. So it's on for about a, it's on, it plays for about a week next summer.
Okay, I'm definitely coming.
And I'm going to, and I'm going to go to every night. And if James lets me, I shall introduce it every night.
And presumably once it's been done, you can't cut any of this, incidentally. All right, this is all gold.
This is a whole take.
This is a whole, you can't cut any of this. This and the Jacob Rees-Mogg is a, is all staying in. Once it's been written, then it, it exists for, so presumably somewhere down the line in a couple of years, a company could go, I would like to do this, the opera.
A Canadian opera company have already done that. So it's a it's a co-production between a Canadian opera company, forgive me,
so
I've forgotten
exciting.
Them, and Opera Holland Park. So
well,
I can report back.
So Australian television, Opera Holland Park,
and Canadian opera. I fancy a trip to Canada next, well, whenever it is they're going to put it on. So.
It's just so amazing.
I have no idea how you turn a children and YA story into an opera, but I will be able to report back.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Matt on this email, dear Lyle Lyle and Crocodile, I'm writing solely because of Mark's Halloween Ends comment that he has, quotes, okay, yet to hear from another person who hasn't left it disappointed.
Okay, yes.
Well, I
here
thought
we go.
He hasn't heard from me.
Okay, good.
Because I'm a well-adjusted person, I decided in the run-up to Ends release to watch all 12 previous films in order in what proved to be an exercise with decidedly mixed results. The original, perfect. Halloween 5 and Halloween Resurrection, utterly redeemable.
Utterly.
I enjoyed almost all of them to some extent, but other than the bizarre Rob Zombie remakes, they were almost completely devoid of surprises or of much story beyond stabby, stabby, run, hide, stabby, stabby. I expected more of the same here, but I had also deliberately avoided the trailer due to the one for Halloween Kills telling the entire story in miniature. And I was blown away, truly. Right from the completely shocking cold opening, which I initially thought the film could never recover from, but which was smartly incorporated into the script and ended up being more than justified. I was totally gripped and never at any point bored. Both myself and my friend thought it was the second best out of the 13, which is praise indeed from franchise fans like ourselves. We definitely did not come out of it disappointed. We were exhilarated and saying things like, that's how it's done. I did not think they had the guts to even attempt to make a film like this, so I'm pleased they did. Anyway, tinkety-tonk, down with the cabbage and up with the lettuce. P.S., by the way, I voted for The Exorcist over The Alien, and I hope this goes some way towards clawing back the credibility I've lost here.
Well, here's the most important thing. Firstly, thank you very much for sending that email. Secondly, opinions are just opinions, and I have always thought this, and it's always lovely to, particularly if you're a fan, if you did the homework as you did. I mean, I've seen all the Halloween movies, although I confess I haven't sat down and done them all as a marathon. In fact, just before we recorded this show, I was showing you, because on YouTube, if anyone's interested, if you Google Mark Kermode, The Night He Came Home, there's a documentary I made about Halloween. I think I made it for BBC Two some years ago, but like everything, it's on YouTube. And it begins with me dressed as Michael Myers in a gag that sounds
very scary.
It's actually quite convincing.
Yes.
And if you have done all that homework, and I mean, one of the first films I ever reviewed for Time Out when I came to London from Manchester was one of the Halloween, you know, Michael Myers Lives Again or whatever it was. And I remember just thinking, this is absolute pants. This is just utterly awful. And I didn't like Halloween Ends at all, but I'm delighted that somebody who's put all that work in and thought about it found it as inventive as you did. So hooray.
Ben Pacheza in York, second time emailer, heritage listener. On the subject of the most adaptable cast prompted by a listener's email, surely we were just speculating about which cast in which movie, if you had to just stick with them for the rest of all time.
Could do any genre.
Yeah. How about the cruelly underrated Cloud Atlas?
That's interesting.
It constitutes the worthiest of shouts. Halle Berry, Tom Hanks, Ben Whishaw, Hugh Grant, Susan Sarandon, Hugo Weaving et al. Show versatility in spades by playing characters spanning different genders, races, ages across five centuries, and in the historical thriller, science fiction, comedy, and dystopian future genres in one admittedly lengthy movie. Where else can you see Hugh Grant under layers of war paint as a post-cataclysmic tribal warrior, or Hugo Weaving as Nurse Ratched's scarier elder sister? It's an interesting suggestion.
I was thinking that the answer to this question would be any one of those disaster movies from the 1970s in which it's a cast of, you know, on the one a cast of everybody, whether it's William Holden, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, Fred Astaire in The Towering Inferno.
Excellent.
You know, that was just what you did. You got a variety cast, then you stuck them on a ship that turned upside down or in a building that caught fire and just let them get on with it.
Steph from East London. Most adaptable cast that came straight to my mind was the cast from The Personal History of David Copperfield, where I feel like all the actors in it have spanned several genres. Dev Patel, Tilda Swinton, Hugh Laurie, Ben Whishaw, Peter Capaldi, Anna Maxwell-Martin, to name a few. Furthermore, comedy is often said by actors to be the hardest genre, and it would be fair to say they've shown their capability for comic timing in that film. Down with the Nazis and Up with Lettuces and the rest of the Anti-Growth Coalition. I suspect the Anti-Growth Coalition will now fade from memory. And no one
who said it?
That was the former Prime Minister, Liz, whatever her name was. She was talking about the Anti-Growth
Coalition. Yeah.
Yes, which kind of...
What an absolutely dumb thing to say out loud.
I don't think anyone else will say it now. Michael in Berlin, further
what
to your...
shower. What a complete shower. That's staying as well.
Edit point. Further to your recent discussions of the advisability or otherwise of wearing corduroy, you may find it of interest that the German word for said garment is Cordhose or Manchester hose, usually pronounced Manchester Hose for reasons too distressing to explain.
You did mention the Manchester thing last week.
I did, yes. Yeah. The latter, a recognition of the city's textile heritage, is a little old-fashioned but still understood. Given Mark's understandable affection for the city in which he studied, can I suggest he consider both referring to and sporting the Manchester trouser from now on in tribute?
Yeah. No.
No. Michael in Berlin mostly wearing a range of fetching Levi cords this season. Correspondence at curbadomain.com.
You haven't gone over to the dark side, have you, on the cords?
No, I just wear jeans. Yeah. Unless I have to suit it and boot it, in which case I can do that.
So it's true, you do live in jeans unless
every
it's
day.
Unless it's a posh occasion.
Unless I go to the palace, in which case I wear a suit. And at no other time. I just don't like suits. I hate ties. I don't like formality, basically.
You hate ties, you hate not the way they look, but you hate wearing a tie. I ask as somebody who's been wearing a tie for many years, have you been looking across the desk? I'm not now, I'm wearing my Jonathan Richmond t-shirt, but have you been looking across the desk at me thinking I hate him because he's wearing a suit and a tie?
Everyone else is fine.
Everyone else is fine, it's just you don't like it.
It's just me. Okay. I'm very happy to dress as a teenager for now and forever.
You know why I wore a suit and tie on television for all those years?
To make you look cool and sophisticated?
No. There is an actual answer to this question, and I shall give it to you. Which is, I used to do Newsnight Review, and when I started doing Newsnight Review, I wore jeans and a t-shirt and a Harrington, and I thought I looked like James Dean. And one day, one of the producers, one of the people, the executives at the BBC, said to me...
Was he called Jonty? Wear a hat indoors.
Called Jonty Blumenet. And and they said, you know what we really like about you? You're the kind of guy that would never wear a suit. And I was so outraged that I wore a suit forevermore after that.
I quite like that.
So I literally did it to annoy an executive.
Well, I think if it annoys an executive, it is by definition a good thing. A good thing.
That's absolutely true.
If you wear a hat indoors, you deserve all the derision that is coming your way.
Precisely.
Correspondence at curbandemeyer.com. Lovely to hear from you for next week. Although I suspect next week, because it's the live show, the chances of me reading emails, I don't know. I'll try and read a few emails, but it might be that there are fewer because we might have to. We'll take
questions from the audience.
From the audience, yeah, all that kind of
stuff. Also, there'll be musical stuff going on. There'll be live interview stuff going on. There'll be cosplay stuff going on.
Also, we're going to execute a chicken.
Pardon?
I didn't say anything. I don't know. It was Alice Cooper I was thinking of.
Okay.
Just for a moment.
Did that actually happen or was that a modern myth?
No, he did. I mean, he did have a guillotine on stage, but it was never...
But he never actually...
did the real thing. They just, you know, it's like a conjuring trick.
Yeah, precisely.
An illusion, I believe. Vanguard Easters get extra review material. What else are we watching?
Yes, so Wendell and Wild, which is... I'm just going to change over my thing that I was on there, which is that one there. Thank you very much. Wendell and Wild, which is an animation which is on Netflix from the 28th, which is from today. Today is the 28th, isn't it? Fine. So now on Netflix, that's the easiest way of doing it. You're looking at your watch, it's quarter past 10. That's today's my
watch. I've got a new watch and it's just telling me it's cloudy and rainy. Tell me the time.
It doesn't tell you what the time is, but it tells you when high tide is.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so directed by Henry Selick, who made Nightmare Before Christmas, the Tim Burton Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach, Monkey Bone. This is co-written by, Coraline. This is co-written by Henry Selick and Jordan Peele, who made Get Out and Us.
It's impressive so far.
And Nope. From a source by Selick and Clay McLeod Chapman. Lyric Ross is the voice of Kat, who, as a child, loses her parents to a car accident for which she blames herself. She was in the back seat of the car. Years later, she returns to her hometown of Rustbank as part of the Break the Cycle program, which has been designed to give talented kids a second chance by sending them to a school where they will flourish. The town is in disrepair. It's in danger of being taken over by two private prison entrepreneurs, one of whom looks suspiciously like Donald Trump, and the other of whom has the voice of Maxine Peake. Meanwhile, Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key, who of course worked together as a comedy duo for a very long time, are the voice of the titular demons, who live in the nostrils of Buffalo Belzer. They spend their days trying to fix his... You have to follow this because this plot gets complicated. They spend their days on his head trying to fix his baldness by inserting hair cream into his empty follicles. And then they discover that the hair cream brings a dead lice back from the dead.
Oh, my goodness.
And then they realise that this may be their ticket to the real world because they can tempt Kat with the prospect of reviving her parents from the dead with hair cream.
Is this on a scroll through, like the Star Wars previously? This is what you need to know.
So it is a very complicated, convoluted plot. The animation is every bit as eye-popping as you'd expect. I mean, at times it goes into cut-out animation. It's got a soundtrack. You're going to love the soundtrack. It's got specials. It's got X-ray specs. It's an absolute, you know, Simon Mayo jukebox favourite. The whole film's got this kind of elegantly punky feel about it. I mean, there's a lot of madness, and I have to say there is a superfluity of plot. There is definitely kind of, sorry, what? Pardon? And once more? But, it, having seen it just the once, I really enjoyed it because I liked the animation and I liked the sort of punky anarcho feel that it had, and I like that kind of ghoulishness for all ages, which I've always been a big fan of. I did certainly get the feeling that if you've watched it five or six times, every time you see it, you will start to find more in there. But it's kind of, you know, it's good fun and it's inventive and adventurous. It's really odd. I mean, it's really genuinely odd. But then again, I suppose James and the Giant Peach is really weird, isn't it? I mean, that's an absolutely mad story. So, yeah, Wendell and Wild, well worth checking out, and it's on Netflix now.
Does it include, in the soundtrack, does it include Where's Captain Kirk by Spiz Energy?
Annoyingly not, which is a really, really great song.
I'm wondering if I can get away with playing it on Greatest Hits. It's a great song.
Oh, what to do when we went Warp Factor to the changes I have been through as Captain Kirk.
That's great. I got that on my jukebox, by the way.
You know what you should also play? Star Trekking across the universe. No,
there's more chance playing that, I suppose, because it was a number one.
Do you know how that record is connected to the Ribettes?
Kevin Bacon.
No, that would get you to the Comsat Angels, but it's not that Kevin Bacon. The Firm, who recorded Star Trekking Across the Universe, and Arthur Daly, He's All Right.
A Little Dodgy Maybe.
A Little Dodgy Maybe. Were a band set up by Tony Thorpe, who was the guitarist of the Ribettes.
Incredible. You should write a book about that. Mm. Time for another round of our new feature. Well, it's not new anymore, A Pretentious Moir.
Excellent.
This is where I read out a paragraph from, or actually this week it's a sentence, from one of Mark's
really?
Reviews from many years
ago. Is it
ago.
A long sentence?
Nope. You have to guess what the film is that you're writing about. So we have some tension-building theme music. Here we go. In a desperate attempt, clearly for the man to win, as opposed to Mark to win, this is a very, very brief quote.
For heaven's sake.
Okay. There is a reference to, right at the very beginning, is a reference to one of the stars of the film. I've removed that word, the surname, with the word hamster.
Hamster, okay.
Okay. Here is today's pretentious moir. Hamster rises magnificently to the challenge of the role, her face flickering between a practiced smile and a silent scream, ripe with contradiction. I'll give it to you again. Hamster rises magnificently to the challenges of the role, her face flickering between a practiced smile and a silent scream, ripe with contradiction.
You know, the worst thing is that I actually recognize that. I recognize it. I can remember writing it.
For £1,000.
I'm going to kick myself.
Do you want a clue?
Yeah.
You've mentioned the person that Hamster refers to in the last 5 minutes in relation to something else.
So it's Florence Pugh, and is that Lady Macbeth? It is Florence Pugh, right?
No.
Oh, okay, fine. So I've mentioned the person in the last 5 minutes.
Correct.
When I was talking about Wendell and Wilde.
I can't give you any more clues. I've given you one lifeline. You have no. And you have no more left.
Okay, I am going to silently scream and kick myself when you tell me that it is
Maxine Peake.
Oh, damn! You know, I was thinking Maxine Peake. Hell's teeth! I was actually thinking Maxine Peake. And of course, I mentioned Maxine Peake.
You know, when you said silently scream, could you do that?
Okay, no. So wait. So.
What am I waiting for?
Okay, go on.
Funny, it's funny. Funny cow. 22nd of April 2018. Maxine Peake.
Okay. No, I accept defeat.
How can you? That's fine. It's one sentence. It's not,
no, I know. No, but here's the weird thing: is I remember writing that sentence. I remember writing that sentence. Okay, three all. Is that's three I've got and three I haven't.
You know what's going to be great?
All. Yeah, go on.
Next week when we do this, I think we should do Pretentious Moi with the live audience
and see whether
and first of all say no prompts. You know, like because you know to give you a chance, and then people can shout.
Okay.
And then you can discard or I think that'd be
that
good.
Was incidentally that was very well chosen because that was just on that sweet spot between I should have got that. But the relief is I do remember writing it. I do remember writing that. I remember writing a practice smile and a silent scream.
We'll do a live version of that next week.
Okay.
One frame back, looking at unpleasant or unwanted house guest films. I don't like any unwanted house guest films. It just feels too horrendous.
Well, because it's your worst fear is an unwanted house guest. Well,
and some of my least favourite movies are about
to be
mentioned.
Is this you quietly telling me that I need to stop coming to your house on a Tuesday night?
No, not at all, because you're about to see from that kind of house guest we're talking about here. Kat Davis says, Housebound, fantastic 2014 comedy horror film from New Zealand. A young thief on house arrest is driven mad by her odd family and the suspected presence of ghosts in the house. Nice twists and turns. Carter says, is it Le Dîner de Con? Haven't seen the American remake with Steve Carell because the trailer looked over the top awful, but the French original is great. Ruth says, Ruth Esbach, it has got to be Parasite, surely. Relentless. First time around, it's absolutely jaw-dropping. Simone Morgan says, Beethoven. James Stewart says, Mother!
Mother!
Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer for really outstaying their welcome. I mean... There you go.
Yeah, I mean...
I hated that film. Lee West says, Mouse Hunt. Tom Bolton, I think it must be Babadook, the scariest film this side of the millennium. Cal says, I know Mark isn't a fan, but for me it has to be Funny Games, 97 by Michael Haneke. It's a brilliant home invasion film. Above all, it also looks at the obsession with violence in the media. So anyway, that's a bunch of what you said this week. What would you select for your one frame back?
Okay, are we choosing a film that I think you should watch, or are we choosing a film that I think most accurately captures that sense of the awfulness of it? No, I mean, because it'll affect my decision.
I like both.
Okay, well, if it's both, obviously Parasite is the one that I think, because you really enjoyed Parasite, didn't you? And that is the one in which it's, you know, the unexpected house guest, the uninvited house guest. I think if you were going to pick one that absolutely got to the awfulness of it, much as I understand the arguments about Funny Games, and, you know, I think Funny Games US was a kind of huge misstep. And much as I love Haneke, and I do, I think the fact that Haneke thought the problem with the German Funny Games was it was in the wrong language kind of demonstrates that I was right about the fact that that film is all over the place and it's nothing like as good as Benny's Video. I am going to go for Mother because that thing about the paranoia about your house having uninvited guests in it, just getting worse and worse and worse and worse, and then leading to that absolutely awful moment. I think Mother is a really good film, but I think it's it's not a terrible film. It's just excruciating to watch. And I watched it sitting next to Alan Jones, who was huffing and puffing like a steam train, because he felt the same way as you did, which was like, needs to stop, you know.
Yeah, or you can just walk out.
Yeah, but you didn't.
No, of course not, because we were doing it for work.
Yeah,
you don't walk out of your work, do you?
Yeah.
Mother. So not recommended, but that's Mark's chosen. Anyway, next week, it's our Halloween special. You might have noticed.
Are tickets still available?
Least scary horror film is what we're after here. So this is the bit in the programme where we're going to be addressing this issue. So it's something which is a horror film. I don't think it can't be a horror film. It has to be.
No, it has to be a horror film.
It has to be a horror film, but the least scary horror film you've ever seen, and why. Correspondence@curbandamayo.com. You can find us on our social channels, OVS.
Yeah, can I tell you that I already know what the answer to this is?
No, because then people won't vote.
Okay.
So even though Mark assumes he knows what's going to happen.
At the moment, the list is still open, yeah?
That's why I've just asked people to get involved.
So just make sure that when the list is drawn up, the one that I know is going to win is on there.
That sounds as though that might be ballot rigging.
No, it's just that there is an answer to the demonstrably least scary horror film ever made.
Okay. Anyway, well, we'll see. Who knows? Correspondence.
It's not a horror film, though, is it? It's a psychological thriller.
It's that
it's
time of the month.
About the way the spirits you collect through the Gothic work with sadness and gain.
Like the end of the month, where we take a look at the physical things that are being released. It's physical product of the month. A very, very clumsy title.
Such a terrible title.
Used to be DVD of the week, but I guess
physical product of the month, Harris Dickinson in Triangle of Sadness.
He is a physical product.
He's a physical product.
Isn't he? Anyway, so this is stuff, this is like hardware. This is something that you can buy, own, and hand on and pass and lend. Gary Clark, most excited for the Criterion edition of The Power of the Dog, if it's a UK release. Visually stunning, breathtaking sound design, hauntingly melancholic. Jason Marden, Vampire Circus, best Hammer vampire film of the 70s, inventive, scary, shocking, with a brilliant climax as the Count rises again for all of 2 minutes. spoiler. Simon Waite, 3,000 Years of Longing and Fall, and just when you thought everyone who's contributing to this feature had a proper name, A Secret on Twitter says, nope, was a lot of fun in the cinema. Lovely homage to Jaws and other Spielberg classics, but with enough of Peele's touches to make it his own. He really was a bit sit back and enjoy experience. Also, looking forward to Fall, which seemed to be at the cinema for one day only. Yeah. Mark, what is our physical product DVD of the month?
Well, I'm going to go for this. Has been released many times before, but evidently it's been reissued because it's on this list. I'm going to go for Audrey Rose, and the reason I am is that I think Audrey Rose is a much underrated horror film. I remember very much enjoying the original Source novel and then very much not enjoying the original Source novel sequel. But watching Audrey Rose for the first time and thinking, yeah, you'd be hard pushed to do this. And Anthony Hopkins, Sir Anthony Hopkins, I think he might have just been Anthony Hopkins at that point. And it's, and Robert Wise, it is a really underrated chiller that I thought was actually very well done. So I am going to go for Audrey Rose, which of course kind of is in the back of The Exorcism of Emily Rose. It's like, it's one of the films that film references, but it's a much better movie. I don't know what physical format it's on. I imagine it's Blu-ray or DVD or something. But if you haven't seen Audrey Rose, do. It's okay. Very, very good.
Okay, so this week's Take It or Leave It, colon, you decide. Again, a clumsy title for a very entertaining feature. It comes from Steve Davis. Not that one, but I suppose it could be.
Could be.
Simon and Mark.
What does the other Steve Davis now does?
He's snooker.
No, but he now does something else.
What, like Fit Boilers?
No, he's like a, he's, it's some, sorry, I have to look this up. Steve Davis, the who made...
The snooker man.
Yes, who was famously the most boring man in the world, which was how he got those adverts, right? He now does something like he's a DJ. Hang on. He's no longer the world's most boring person. He is currently a musician, DJ and author. And apparently he's quite a banging DJ. So that, and when I'm calling him boring, this is not a criticism.
Does that mean he puts records on in fields? And in clubs.
Well, yeah, I imagine that that is probably what it means. But, you know, it's here we go. Music. He joined Chaz and Dave 7 in September. He appears in music. Well, anyway, he is now apparently a banging DJ thing. And as I said, saying he's boring is not criticizing him because he actually used that as a, you know, it was boringly reliable, wasn't it? That was, he was something, but apparently not boring.
Okay, well, it might be him, but it's probably not.
Hello, Steve, in that case.
Simon and Mark.
Love the show.
Have either of you seen RRR on Netflix yet? If not, you're missing out. If you have, what did you think? So this is RRR. Yes. For anyone who hasn't seen it, it has non-stop action, set pieces, English baddies hamming it up, amazing special effects, and will have you grinning from ear to ear at some of the scenes and cringing at others. It clocks in at just over 3 hours, but it flies by. Why have I never watched an Indian film before? Absolutely brilliant, but nuts and over the top with it. It is certainly the most entertaining film I've seen this year. Like to hear Mark's thoughts on it. That's why we've included it for Take It or Leave It, you decide.
Yeah, so I have seen RRR, Rise, Roar, Revolt, although there actually was a long thing, long time.
What's it stand for again?
Rise, Roar, Revolt is now the accepted title. There was sort of discussion for a while about other things. The reason that this is maybe the first Indian film that you've seen, this is an absolute international smash, and I should confess that I made a program that was about this last year for another thing that I was doing. This topped.
Does it, you do another thing?
I do another thing.
Okay.
This topped the, you know, like you do your
I
drive
do
time.
Thing.
Yeah, exactly. We both do other
oh,
things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We have an
true.
Open relationship.
That's true.
It's fine.
Your scholar is very good.
Thank you very much. And I lead straight into your scholar show, which is also very good.
Yeah. And Greatest Hits Drive Time,
which is also very
four
good.
4 till 7.
Yeah. Although, unless there's power cuts.
I mean, target. Now, the power
targeting
cuts,
the,
that was under the pre. Was that the previous regime or
I
the one
remember.
Before that? The Ancien regime said power cuts.
The haunted pencils person who he was working with.
In fact, it was it was head of the National Grid said 4 till 7. So get your gas powered, oil powered generators out now, unless you want to miss the show.
Anyway, if we can come back to
sorry, I beg your pardon. Yes.
When RRR opened in cinemas, it topped the global. World, you know, the box office. When it came to Netflix, it rapidly became the most watched non-English language film in the company's history. This is not entirely surprising since it's directed by S.S. Rajmouli, whose previous film, the 2015 film Bahubali and its sequel, were credited with kicking off pan-Indian cinema and who has also topped the global box office before. So he is probably, you know, one of the most successful filmmakers in the world.
At the moment.
Well, yeah. And it's the fact that there are listeners in the UK who won't be immediately familiar with his name, like Steven Spielberg or Michael Bay, that is absolutely to do with looking at things from our perspective, because these films are massive, like absolutely massive. It's made in Hyderabad and in Telugu, so not a Bollywood film, and one has to be very careful about not falling into that particular trap. Three of the biggest stars in Indian cinema, Rama Rao Jr., Ram Charan, and Alia Bhatt, and you remember Alia Bhatt because I talked about her film Gangi by Katya Vardi, which is also on Netflix, and which incidentally I would say is a better film than RRR, and I mean it's more challenging, but if you get a chance to watch Gangi by Katya Vardi, that is on Netflix, and it's really worth seeing. So RRR is a 1920 set epic period bromance about two real life heroes, and forgive my pronunciation, Alluri Sitarama Raju and Komaram Bhim, who never met in real life. In the film, it imagines that they did meet and that they come together against the British colonials. It is also significant that Rajmouli, who was on the program that I was talking about before, said that one of his key influences is Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson's The Patriot, Mel Gibson's Braveheart, and also Mel Gibson's Apocalypto. Because what he said he loves about Gibson's filmmaking is the way that he will stretch a dramatic moment to its fullest. Okay, which I think is actually a very good description of what Mel Gibson's filmmaking does. So there are larger than life characters. Everything is cranked up. There's music. It's M.M. Keeravani, who of course is Rajmouli's cousin. And then there are 7 original songs, including Nutu Nutu, which you might have heard because I've been playing some of them on Scala for quite a while. The film is so easy to enjoy. I mean, it is the most crowd-pleasing film you've seen in a long time. It's literally like it's, there's no sense of this is going to be, you know, it's like, here we go, we're going to grab you emotionally, we're going to give you action sequences that are just thrilling, we're going to give you characters who are larger than life, you're almost superheroes, but not.
Is it a thriller? Is that the genre?
It's an action thriller, epic period romance, historical fiction with songs.
Is that all?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, and you know the everything but the kitchen sink? No, I'll have the kitchen sink. We'll throw that in as well. And it's what's really fascinating about it is that it's become this huge sensation because it's had this massive, massive global impact. But it has a track record that when you look at it, you go, okay, well, fine. You know, with that director and that composer and those stars and that story, we can sort of see how we got to this point. But the fact that it's now people are finding it on Netflix. What I would really hope is that people use this as a kind of entry and use that and then go, okay, fine, now what else is there? And, you know, watch Gangi by Katyavadi, watch Padman. Padman was this extraordinary Indian film, came out a couple of years ago. A really, really fantastically engaging drama about a guy who decides that the greatest problem facing his village is the lack of sanitary products for women who are becoming ill because nobody talks
about this. Yeah.
And it's the film has a completely mainstream appeal to it, but it's about a subject that Hollywood movies would not touch with a 10-foot plague pole. And there is so much, I mean, for us, the whole thing about, you know, Indian cinema is not a thing. It is loads and loads of different things because it's almost a world market in and of itself. Rise, Roar, Revolt is one of those films that has broken through across all the various markets and has become a global smash. And it's really easy to see why. Honestly, the 3 hours fly by because it's just, there's no moment in the film in which the film isn't trying to grab your attention and, you know, and it does it. It's, you know, it's a hugely enjoyable watch.
And it's RRR and you can see it on Netflix.
Or, as you said,
RRR. If there is something that you think we should be looking at and maybe has been under-discussed or not discussed at all,
yeah,
get in touch. correspondence@copenhagenmail.com. Thank you for listening. There'll be a take three along very shortly. It'll be one of our questions, schmestions thing. Don't forget, you can send those in any time. So film questions are the questions and the non-film questions are the schmestions. And we still need, ideally, a rabbi to say that properly.
Yes.
Because the way I'm saying it sounds just pathetic.
A bit naff.
Send it on a voice note, please, if you can say it properly. If you speak Yiddish, just send it in properly, please. And that'll be correspondence@copenhagenmail.com. We'll see you for take three.